Okay, so we'll get started. I'll first ask if there are any announcements. Okay, I have a couple of things. First of all, I sent that in my email. The Clean Network does have, as of a couple of weeks ago, actually, a new homepage, which I think looks very nice, so everybody can go. When I send the emails out, usually I send you straight to the teleconference page, but the homepage looks kind of nice now and is easy to use. So I just want to let everybody know that. And then the other thing is that AGU now has the site open to accept session proposals. The deadline is not until April. And we have a talk next week, but the following week will, so I just want to get people started thinking. I'll start organizing conveners around the various climate literacy sessions so that we can, like we have the past few years, submitted a suite of session proposals for AGU on climate literacy. So think about what you're interested in helping organize, and we'll have that discussion in a couple of weeks. Are there any other announcements?
This is Roberta Burns. I was wondering if anybody was going to be in on the Communicating About Winter Climate Impacts webinar tomorrow that Climate Access is putting on. Do people know about that?
It looks really great.
Yeah, I know I could sure use some help with that. People are pulling the old global warming, schmorming thing here.
So what's the name of that again?
It's called Communicating About Winter Climate Impacts. It's a Climate Access Roundtable webinar, and it's tomorrow, 1 o'clock Eastern, 10 o'clock Pacific. You can join by going to Climate Access. You have to sign up if you're not a member. It doesn't cost anything, but then you can get in on this, and it's free.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. If you if it haven't already, you can send out the email to the list, the information to the listserv for anybody who might be interested.
Okay.
Yeah, that would be wonderful.
Okay, great. Any other announcements? Okay, then we'll move on to our presentation today. We have David Brooks from the Institute for Earth Science Research and Education. David has a PhD in atmospheric physics, and he has been a researcher at NASA's Langley Research Center and a research professor at Drexel University. And he's also, and this is where I first met David, was as a PI of the atmospheric science component of the GLOBE program. And so he founded the Institute for Earth Science Research and Education in 2004, and he has been a champion of developing authentic research experiences for students and teachers. And so he's going to be talking to us today about developing a project-based STEAM program around environmental climate science, and the slides are on the website, so I'm assuming everybody has downloaded those. So with that, David, I will turn it over to you.
Thank you, Tamara. There go my first two slides. Thank you for the introduction. does everybody have these slides now available?
Yes.
Okay. And I did number them so that we can go back and forth as required. One of the things I think that may be significant, I don't know if any of you are classroom teachers, but significantly missing from my background is any classroom teaching experience. So those of you that are teachers can take that into account as you evaluate whatever I have to say. But as Tamara said, my interest here is developing really good inquiry and research-based science programs, and particularly within the STEM paradigm, or what's now being called the STEAM paradigm, as people move toward incorporating the arts into this paradigm. Feel free to interrupt anyway, by the way, any time you need to do that. So I've moved on to slide 3. These are my ideas of what it is that a STEAM program should do. Obviously, the first thing that it needs to do is integrate all of the components of the STEM, now the STEAM paradigm. Arts is increasingly a part of this paradigm. Technology and engineering tend to be shortchanged in favor of science and mathematics, which are more traditional topics to be dealt with in school. And I think it's really important that these kinds of programs have multiple input points for students. Not everybody is going to be a climate scientist or an environmental scientist, but there are all sorts of things that need to be done within this paradigm, and it needs to accommodate a wide range of abilities, or else the programs aren't really doing their job right. And it seems to me that this paradigm is as much about process as it is about content. This is not something that can be taught as a traditional subject. This is my thinking, anyhow. You can't teach a STEM program like you teach physics or biology. It has to be taught and learned differently. And one of the things that I really like to see coming out of this sort of a STEM paradigm is to change schools' perceptions of themselves as to include being viewed as centers for education and research. I don't think that any successful STEAM program can be sustainable without a long-term institutional commitment. And this is really hard for schools to do. I think this is probably the hardest part of changing the way a STEM program works. It would be nice if schools thought of themselves as centers for creativity and student research instead of centers for standardized testing, which is increasingly a problem, and I know it's a problem that teachers are increasingly concerned about, teachers and parents both. Just locally here in Pennsylvania and New Jersey, there's a groundswell of people who are opting their students, parents who are opting their students out of standardized testing. It's basically a movement. The last part of this is, how do you assess student outcomes? Since these programs don't deal specifically with subject-specific testing, it seems to me that standardized testing isn't really a very good way, a very good metric for assessing these kinds of programs. People can disagree with that, and please speak up if you have some comments about that. So I'm moving on to page 4. And one of the things that I've been personally really interested in is trying to make sure that when teachers think about teaching science, especially in this sort of broader STEAM content, that they think carefully about the difference between inquiry and research when their students are doing things. On page 4, there's the National Research Council definition of inquiry. This dates back to 1996. It defines a process, and it has all the parts of the scientific process in there. But if we move on to page 5, my question is, when students do these environmental and climate things, are they doing inquiry or are they doing research? And I think this is an important question to ask in the STEAM context. Again, inquiry is about process. Research is process plus content. You can have inquiry without research, but not the other way around. And my test of whether students are doing research or not in these programs is when they do a project, when they complete a project or an investigation, and they communicate the results, will anybody care about what they've done? And if the answer is yes, then it could qualify as real, authentic student research. And if the answer is no, it might be interesting, but it's not really research. And I think that distinction is important, because if students aren't doing actual research sometimes, they're going to have a hard time generating outside interest in what they're doing. Scientists who basically want to mentor students, they're not going to be interested in doing that if the students aren't doing something that's interesting. There's a link on page 5 to a workshop that I organized back in 2010 dealing with this issue. Now, this the grant that we're working on now, our institute is working on now, it's a three-year grant funded by the Toyota USA Foundation. It's one of 23 grants awarded nationwide in 2014. And it's facilitating environmental science inquiry and research for students and educators, what we call FESRs. Within this model of whether students are doing research, what we're trying to do with this grant, which is sort of a continuation of the NASA Climate Change Education grant that we finished last year, we ask students to submit a research proposal. It's not a competition, but it does require that the proposal has to make sense and scientific sense in some age appropriate way, and it has to show that students understand what they want to do and why. And in return for those proposals, we're providing science mentoring and technical assistance and equipment. Most of the equipment is what we've developed ourselves at the Institute. Some of it is available on loan. Some of it students can build themselves. And the idea of asking students to do this is that what we want to do is model the same kind of process that quote-unquote real scientists have to do when they try to get support for their work. It's also the case now that under this Toyota-funded program, schools can also apply for implementation grants for general support of environmental science activities in their school. This is available through a partnership with a new organization called Youth Learning as Citizen Environmental Scientists, YLACES. It was started by Dixon Butler last year. As some of you probably know, Dixon is the former head of the GLOBE program. So in collaboration with students submitting research proposals for things they'd be interested in doing, we will also work with schools to get implementation grants of up to $1,000 for equipment to support ongoing science projects in their school. So within this paradigm, on page 6, I've sort of given some definitions here of the five components of the STEAM paradigm. Probably you all know about that. The science definitions tend to be physical sciences as opposed to life sciences, including environmental science, earth science. Technology and engineering, I think, are the harder components because people aren't so used to dealing with those. Everybody knows about mathematics and trying to incorporate that into the STEAM paradigm. The arts is something new, and I think one has to try to be pretty creative and think about how to actually integrate arts into a STEAM curriculum, and I have an example of that a little later on. So, moving on to page 7, one of the ideas that we've had is to organize a STEAM program around a particular science focus. To see how that works. And the one that I picked is pyranometry, the measurement of solar radiation. The first question is, can you use this particular science focus as a way to incorporate all the components of the STEAM paradigm? You need to ask yourself, does it reach students with a wide range of interests and aptitudes? And I think it's important to ask if such a project will produce scientifically useful data that students can use for their own research. And hopefully, over the long run, schools would archive these data for future students as well. That is, they would start acting like research institutes. Because, as I said before, this idea of encouraging long-term institutional commitments is really important, I think, for successful STEAM programs. So on page 8, what about the science of pyranometry? If we look at the individual components of the STEAM paradigm now, we can start out with science. The question is, does it have a strong science component? And I think the answer is pretty obviously yes. Solar radiation is the primary driver for Earth's climate. This graphic here that's on page 8 is taken from I forget the reference now, but it's a basic earth science text. And it's the kind of graphic that you see in every earth science text showing the incoming radiation. You know, some of it's absorbed in the atmosphere, some of it's reflected, and it radiates, the Earth's surface radiates thermal energy. Some of it's absorbed and re-radiated by the atmosphere because of the greenhouse effect. And we know that the Earth has to be in radiative balance as viewed from space, but at the ground level, the radiative balance is changing, and that's climate change. So there's obviously a lot of really important science in this one measurement. If we take a look at page 9 now, if we think about the mathematics component, this is just one example that I used as a way to think about the mathematical aspects of climate modeling. This is like a zero order model. In this model, you could think of the Earth as a round ball with clouds painted on the surface, so that the incoming and reflected solar radiation isn't affected by the atmosphere at all, which is somewhat of a simplification. Roughly 29% of the incoming solar radiation is reflected. A lot of people know that now. That is that the Earth's planetary albedo is viewed from space is about 29%. Some of the thermal emissions from the Earth then are absorbed in the atmosphere, and they're re-radiated upward and downward, and the emissivity of the atmosphere, that's due to the greenhouse effect. And you can actually do a lot of interesting mathematics just with this model. But there are other things that you can do as well with pyranometry data or other kinds of data in terms of mathematics. You need to think about collecting data, about organizing it, interpreting it. And also the idea of data mining, existing data, is really an important thing for students to do. This is a very noisy line, by the way. Are people having the same noise that I'm hearing?
I'm hearing a little bit of static in the background. So if everybody can mute their phones, do *6, that will help some of the static.
Yeah, okay. It doesn't sound like feedback static. I don't know what it is, but can people deal with it?
I can unhear you just fine.
Okay. So, science and mathematics, if we look at technology and engineering, there's a bunch of questions within these two components, and my point here is that these questions are the same regardless of whether you're building $10 instruments or $10 million instruments. Because in my perspective, especially a pyranometry-based, project-based STEAM program, the technology and engineering has to do with measuring things. So, you know, you have to ask, you know, what is it we want to measure and why do we want to measure it? And if we do it, will anybody care? You know, what do we need to know about the science? What kind of tools do we have available to make this measurement? You know, how do we build and calibrate an instrument? How do we collect the data? And what do we do about data quality? And how do we communicate our results? So just these questions incorporate, they're really cross-disciplinary questions, because you have to think about all the other components when you think about the technology and engineering. So on page 11, I've come back to pyranometry again, and the question is, how does this one particular instrument? You can build this instrument for about $10, by the way. We always build them in our professional development workshops, and when we work with students. So if we take each of the components here, the science part we've already talked about. This, you use this instrument to measure incoming solar radiation. These things are very durable. I've had them working 24/7, continuously monitoring insulation for several years, and you know, their calibrations are amazingly stable. In terms of technology, in the upper right there, what I've used as an example of that is using data loggers to collect these data. These devices that I have shown here, they're Arduino-based microcontrollers. And I don't know how many of you know about Arduino microcontrollers. In fact, let me ask, how many people are familiar with that?
I'm not.
I've used them before.
Small air monitors.
Yeah.
We've been experimenting with them a little.
Yeah.
Okay, we've used them in the past. They're handy.
Yeah. Yeah. I would say that these devices, those of you that have used them know that these things are being used all over the world. Their use is so widespread now that, in my view, they're sort of the early 20th century equivalent of the computer, the personal computer revolution in the late 20th century. That I would say that for today's students, some familiarity with microcontrollers in a technology and engineering sense is as essential as, you know, knowing how to use Excel and Microsoft Word or whatever. It's just a huge effort being expended. There's a whole industry built up around supporting these devices. So the engineering part is designing and building these instruments and calibrating them, these instruments and related instruments. And you have to ask yourself the questions that I posed before: what do we want to measure? How are we going to do it? How are we going to design these instruments? What does it mean to calibrate them? How do we archive the data? How do we interpret it? Now, the mathematics is kind of a no-brainer here. There's data analysis. The graph that I showed there is solar insolation for, I almost can't read it. Oh, it's July of, I can't read the date because that's so small. But it's some recent data from
July 1st, 2013.
Oh, okay. Thank you. Yeah. These data are from NOAA's U.S. Climate Reference Network. All of those sites they have pyranometers at them, not as a primary measurement, but to support the other measurements that they've made. This particular data set has been provided to me by NOAA. It's on our institute website. Students can access these data, the Climate Reference Network, the NOAA U.S. Historical Climatology Network, and also the NOAA-produced 30-year climate normals. These are really interesting data, and as some of you may know, the U.S. Historical Climatology Network, the USHCN, that's the source of historical information about whether temperatures are changing, for example, in the U.S. And there's a lot of controversy about how NOAA has dealt with those data. But these applications give people access to not only to pyranometer data within those networks, but also all the other data in these networks. Now, the arts is kind of interesting. Does anybody have an idea what that picture on the lower right is? Any thoughts about what it is?
It looks like bioluminescence or something.
Yeah, almost. It's almost like coral or something.
Sorry, what was that last one?
Or could be some kind of topography of some kind?
Or it's trees.
Ah, yes, it is trees.
Took me a minute, but...
How many of you familiar with an organization called Public Lab?
No. I don't know them.
Nobody.
Citizen Science Initiative out of Philadelphia?
They've had some workshops in Philadelphia, I know that. But it's an organization that's really interested in taking inexpensive approaches to science. This particular image is done with a standard digital camera that's been modified to record the near infrared in one of its channels. I don't know how much you know about how digital cameras work, but you know the sensors, they record red, green, and blue values, and those sensors are sensitive to near infrared radiation as well. And typically in these kinds of cameras, the sensors have laid over them a near IR blocking filter so that they don't see any near IR. This particular camera has been modified so that the near IR filter has been taken off and a red filter has been placed over it instead. So the blue channel records the near infrared. And as some of you may know, there's something called the Normalized Difference Vegetation Index, the NDVI, that basically it requires knowing the near-infrared reflectance and the visible reflectance. So these modified cameras give you a way to actually do that. And the images can be very beautiful. There's many ways to process these. This particular processing, the grayscale stuff is the sky and clouds. The green stuff is trees. This is late in the fall, so the leaves are starting to fall. So the green is areas that are still photosynthetically pretty active, and the blue is stuff where it's a little less active. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of an interesting image. And like I say, artistically, these depending on how you process these images, they can be very beautiful in addition to containing a lot of scientific information. So it's one way to incorporate the arts into the STEAM paradigm. Another thing I wanted to do here is play something for you, and an audio file, and we'll have to see how it sounds here. The static on my end of the line is really pretty bad. So let's see what happens here if we play this and see if people can hear it. So here goes. Did everybody hear that?
Yeah,
very
I was
cool.
able to hear it. It sounds, sounds like chimes of various frequencies.
Any idea what it represents? I wouldn't say that the answer to this is obvious, but does anybody have thoughts about it as to what it might be?
Well, I'll hazard a guess.
Okay, good.
If it's in the context of... If it's in the context of your taking these pyrometry measurements, could it be that it's the variation in the signal as clouds pass in front of the sun or something like that?
That's actually a pretty good guess, and it could be. This particular file isn't that. How many of you are familiar with the MIDI, what's called the MIDI interface?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
The Musical Instrument Digital Interface?
Yes.
No.
This file is a result of a little program that I wrote to create MIDI files from scratch from time series of data, where the data values are transformed into pitch and volume. Mm-hmm. The MIDI standard has 127 standardized instruments. This is one that I just chose. It's what they call their tubular bells instrument. That's why it sounds the way it does. But this file is actually what it is the MIDI translation of mean annual average temperatures at Allentown, Pennsylvania, dating back to the 1800s.
Interesting. Are these annual temperatures or monthly temperatures? Yeah, annual temperatures.
In fact, we could listen, now that you know what it is, we could listen to it again, and you can see what, if anything, interesting is in it.
This time it's cutting in and out a lot.
Yeah.
Last time I could hear the whole thing.
So there you go. It may not be music, but it's interesting.
Mm-hmm. So is it my imagination or is the pitch rising?
And it is not your imagination. It is rising.
Very
which
cool.
would mean that the NOAA processing of these data has concluded that temperatures are rising in Allentown as a function of time.
David, is there a way to listen, essentially have to compare two sort of sites, which would have all different time series, and actually use sort of our abilities to discern differences in sound as a way of sort of getting this sort of big picture sense of how the two sites might differ in terms of their insulation? Or is it just, am I asking for too much musical ability for people?
Well, no, I mean, the whole point here is that, you know, these are the kind of questions that I think if you turn this sort of a thing loose on people, that they will start asking those questions. Can you compare two sites? Well, yes, you can. You just need to build a time series of whatever it is that you want to compare. And can you make it really music? Well, I don't know. Somebody else might be able to do that. But to my way of thinking,
that's the A part in C, of course.
Sorry, say again?
I was just going to say that's the A part in the STEAM part of this project.
Yes.
The artist. Exactly.
And, you know, what strikes me as really interesting about this example is that it really is an integration of art into the other components. It's not just something that's tacked on. It's making use of actual data to create something. And I would love to find high school music students or something like that to turn them loose on something like this and see what they came up with. It would be music or dance or whatever. So anyhow, that's my musical adventure. As some of you may know, there's all sorts of MIDI software for creating music, but I'm not aware of any software that will simply allow you to generate, to take time series of data and generate MIDI files from them.
Yeah.
Did you create this? How did you create the one you just played?
Well, I wrote my own software to do it.
Oh, I see. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it's not necessarily obvious because the MIDI format is they're binary files and their format is kind of obscure. But once you have it worked out, you can do limited things like this. So that's what I did. So anyhow, that's the STEAM part. Moving on to page 12 here, one of the things that I would like to do more of is, in terms of providing background information for students, I would like more, in a context where there's time to do this kind of thing, to ask students to provide their own backgrounds. If you're going to focus, let's say, for a relatively long period of time, a STEAM program around a particular science focus, I think it makes sense to start asking students to do this sort of stuff. And about pyranometers, I have a list of questions here that you could ask students to work up their own presentations on. You know, what do pyranometers do? How do they work? How do I know if what I get is reasonable? What can pyranometers tell me about the seasons and the weather and the climate? So this incorporates writing because they're going to have to, you know, they're going to have to present this stuff themselves. They're going to have to do their own investigations. And I think it provides a means of a sort of a pre-assessment of what they're doing. You know, what do they know ahead of time? How do they apply what they already know? Where do they go to learn new content? Are they willing to admit that they haven't found all the answers, which is actually a problem with students? You know, can they present stuff that's correct and relevant? And what kind of presentation skills do they have? So these are the kind of things that I would want to do up front with students. And on page 13, here's sort of my list of the kind of skills that I think will result from this kind of an authentic research program within a STEAM paradigm. that you have to be able to produce your own questions. You have to gather the science and background. These are skills that I think would be accessible and that students need to have. But you need to be able to design an experiment and write a research proposal. I just this past weekend did some judging at our regional science fair, and a lot of the students are using, for their research projects, they're using stuff they've downloaded from Science Buddies. I assume some of you are familiar with Science Buddies?
Yeah.
Yes?
Yeah.
No, I've not.
Yes.
Ah. Well, it's an online place you can go to find science fair projects. And I don't have any problem with them per se. I mean, there are other sites like that too. But a lot of times what they are is basically just cookbook protocols for doing stuff. So, you know, students don't have to design anything. They don't have to write their own research proposal.
Mm-hmm.
It maybe teaches them how to follow rules, but it doesn't teach them how to design an experiment. So that's kind of a bad thing, I think. They need to know what it means to build and calibrate an instrument, and how you organize your data. They need to develop communication skills, not only with their peers, but also with the people that are mentoring them. And it's a real problem to get students to interact with mentors. They need to be able to present their results. And I think one of the most important things is that they have to develop and demonstrate the ability to apply new skills in other contexts. Because, you know, if students don't learn how to apply the process in a more generalized way, then we've sort of failed them, I think. So the last slide here, these are some photos from workshops that I've done in the past. And ideally, when I work with students and teachers, what we'd like to have is students and teachers working together. I think that's the best way to approach this sort of thing. And if you're working with teachers who aren't comfortable with doing that kind of thing, then they're the wrong teachers. So in this photo, the guy in the upper left-hand photo there, the one with the beard, his t-shirt says, "If I'm talking, you're supposed to be taking notes." And for him, I think it was tongue-in-cheek. For the other pictures, you know, these are workshops where people are building pyranometers. And one of the questions is, who are the teachers and who are the students? Like in the lower left-hand photo, who do you think are the teachers and who do you think are the students?
Well, it's hard to see the two women, so.
Yeah, it is a little hard to tell. In the upper right photo, they're all, one thing I like about taking photos at these workshops when we build this stuff is everybody is so intent. They're all building their pyranometers.
Yes.
the woman in the gray sweater, I think, is a teacher, but she might be a student. I'm not actually sure, which is the way I like it. In the lower right photo, of those three young women, which do you think is the mentor and which do you think are the high school students?
I guess I would say the woman on the left is the mentor. But
other thoughts? Well, it's actually the woman in the middle. She was this was back when I was at Drexel. She was a Drexel engineering student. And the fact that you can't tell who's who, to me, is a plus, because everybody is really working collaboratively on these projects. Mm-hmm. So anyhow,
David, in your current work, are you involved with particular schools or school districts or individual teachers? How do you have this organized?
Yeah, with respect to the Toyota USA Foundation grant, which we were very pleased to get, by the way, it was one of only 23 that they awarded in 2014. We're working with the Iowa Junior Academy of Sciences because we're trying to generate professional development and student activities there. The problem with the Toyota grant was it was awarded last spring, but they asked asked the awardees not to advertise it until and Toyota made its formal corporate announcement, which didn't happen until late September. So it was kind of late to recruit schools for this school year. We are, however, now working just earlier this month. I was up in New York City. We're working with a charter school in Manhattan. It's what I would call an alternative high school. They have 5 days a week, a 2.5-hour STEM program for some of their students. So we're interested in working with teachers and with students as groups, and also we're doing a couple of individual projects with students. There's a couple of students out in Iowa who are measuring water quality in the Des Moines River. And, you know, in that case, we followed our model. I asked them to write a research proposal, which they did. And even though, you know, water quality is not something that I know a lot about, we provided some Lamont test kits for them to use to monitor nitrates and phosphates. I'm working now with a student in upper New York State who's using these applications that I wrote for accessing NOAA data. She's looking at 30-year climate normals, you know, data mining, to examine the effect of interstate highways on average temperatures. So those are the kind of things that we're interested in doing. In the first case, it actually involves some equipment that the school couldn't afford. They couldn't afford the Lamont testing kits. In the second case, it's less a matter of equipment than it is in science mentoring as to helping guide students to use these data and, you know, to do reasonable science with them. But we're looking for partners. They're hard to find. We're looking for school-based partners and for individual students who want to do this sort of science.
How many students or teachers can you are you shooting for?
Let me just say that at this point, there's no upper limit on it. If there gets to be an upper limit, then I'll worry about that.
Okay. So, David, another question. A lot of times, being able to see a change requires a long time base. Can the students in either
the water
quality case or the or in the pyrometer measurements case connect to longer term data sets to compare?
Well, in some cases there are sources of data, but that question really has to do with what I said before about getting students to think of them as getting schools to think of themselves as institutions that really support student research. And one of the things that they need to do is to start archiving their own data just for the purpose that you mentioned. So yes, these kinds of environmental and climate stuff, it's basically long time series of things. So yes, we need sources of information, we need readily accessible sources of information, and we need schools to start archiving their own data. I mean, in terms of the NOAA data, for example, I mean, it's kind of odd because, you know, we just finished our NASA-funded project last year, and the data that I mostly used was not NASA data, but NOAA data, because NOAA data is more relevant to, I think, to what students can understand and work with. All of those data are available online for free, but using them isn't free. I mean, it doesn't cost money, but there's a tremendous learning hurdle to accessing those data, which is why I wrote the applications for looking at those three data sources, the Climate Reference Network. Does everybody know what the Climate Reference Network is? Are you aware of that?
No, I don't want to describe it. Go ahead and describe it.
Yeah. The other data set is the Historical Climatology Network, which is comprises of over 1,000 stations around the country. And NOAA has gotten a lot, historically, they've gotten a lot of flack about what they've done to interpret those data and the way they've interpreted them. and also the quality of the data themselves. There was a whole cottage industry a few years ago of people going around and looking at stations within the USHCN, the Historical Climatology Network, and posting photos of them online. And, you know, some of them were next to highways. There was a famous one in Arizona that was in the parking lot of the meteorology building, you know, surrounded by asphalt and close to a building. So the U.S. Climate Reference Network, it was NOAA's attempt to fix that for now and the future. These are sites, now there's 100 and some sites, I forget the exact number, located around the country in environmentally stable areas. A lot of them are national parks, for example. Some of them are near airports, but and small research stations. Some of them are out in the middle of nowhere. When I say airport, I'm talking about like an airstrip in the middle of a desert somewhere. And that's an attempt to produce a really reliable, long-term data record. It started in 2001. The first station was in Asheville, North Carolina, where the National Climate Data Center is. So all of those data are available online, and they're very, for the most part, they're very high-quality data. And like I say, it's an attempt to solve the problems that NOAA had with interpreting the data from the U.S. HCN, the Historical Climatology Network, because a lot of those data aren't really very good. So I don't know if that answers your question or not, Tamara.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah, that's the other piece of it is I know that when you were part of the GLOBE program, a lot of data was collected as part of that. Is that useful data to you now?
Which data are you talking about?
The data collected as part of the GLOBE protocols.
You know, I would say not, because the quality control was I don't know who's turned the radio on there.
Somebody's got to turn the music off. Please. Thank you. Please mute
okay.
That.
Interlude here.
It's still there. Can we get rid of it?
It's still there, yeah.
Surely we can get rid of it.
We have control over each individual call.
Are we there?
Can hear you, David. This is Scott.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
What I did is I went in online and I had to individually I muted each phone until it finally cut out. But I didn't realize
that
I was actually muting everybody. So I did finally get it to go.
Okay. So okay, your question was whether the GLOBE data are good for that, and you know,
yes.
Right.
You know, I have really mixed opinions about that. If you look at temperature data, for example, just as one example, I mean, there's never been any quality control on those data. So you
mm-hmm.
know, I would say basically to the answer to your question is no.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't think that scientists are really going to be very interested in those data. I really don't.
Okay.
Which is kind of too bad, and I can also be wrong about that. But, I mean, it depends. If you want to do real science with them, you know, you have to have data control, data quality control, and
mm-hmm.
it's been missing.
Well, what about the data that the protocols you developed, were those quality controlled? I thought you had checked them, but I'm not sure. I don't really remember.
Well, I haven't personally checked them. There was some quality control steps built into the processing. You're talking about the sun photometer data now,
right? Yeah.
For example, the processing required three samples and three independent samples taken within a few minutes of each other, And from looking at the range of those samples, you could make some estimates of whether the data were any good or not. And a lot of those, some of those data were actually used, especially in Europe, through KNMI, the Dutch Research Institute. Those were incorporated in peer-reviewed journal publications. And the instruments themselves, the globe sun photometers, were very comfortable with the data quality control on the instruments because, you know, I've calibrated them myself.
Mm-hmm.
Using reference instruments that were calibrated at Mauna Loa Observatory.
Mm.
So, this is a big problem. It really is. It's a whole other discussion of what to do about that kind of thing. But I do think in the context of this discussion, the important thing is to school is for schools to start taking some responsibility for doing this kind of thing. And it's very rare, and in fact, maybe impossible to find schools that are actually doing that.
Yeah, and is it possible to impose a quality control on the schools that you're working with now?
Yes. I mean, it depends on what measurements they're doing. If they're doing pyranometry with our instruments, it's possible mm-hmm. to impose quality control on it. The first way is that we know the characteristics of those particular instruments. And there are actually data checks that you can apply to pyranometer data to determine whether you're getting reasonable values or not. You mm-hmm. can use, for those data, you can use what are called clear sky insolation models. You know, you find a nice, clear, dry day, and you can sort of, you can predict pretty accurately what the insolation should be as a function of time.
Mm-hmm.
And you just compare that model to what they're getting, and that imposes a certain level of data quality control.
Mm-hmm.
But it requires constant interaction between students,
right.
teachers, and whoever is monitoring the thing. And that's an extremely difficult relationship to build and to sustain.
Mm-hmm.
And as I said before, I don't think that STEAM programs are going to work unless those relationships get developed. They're just
mm-hmm.
they're just going to be different ways of doing the same old thing.
Yeah.
You know?
David, this is Scott. Just sort of a related question. It strikes me there's a tension here between, this kind of clarity around data quality and all that sort of, in some ways, things that have protocols associated with it, and then that notion that you want student-directed research as opposed to inquiry. So, you know, there's a tension between sort of creating kind of a recipe that has deeply embedded data protocols in it, and also the sort of the free range that you really want students also to engage in. How do you handle that sort of tension between those two things that I think at least are in opposition?
Yeah, well, I sort of agree with you. And if you think back about the early days of the GLOBE program, I mean, think about air temperature measurements, for example. It was all done manually.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you had to go out, to your little temperature enclosure and, you know, you had to record them. You were supposed to record them at certain times of the day. So it was very, that protocol was very recipe-driven.
Yes.
If you think of doing automated data collection, the recipe gets a lot less egregious.
Mm-hmm. And then we get the consistency.
So you can focus more. I mean, not only do you have more data and probably better data, but you're sort of freed a little bit from the drudgery of the manual data collection so that you can focus on the creative part of it. I mean, pyranometry is the same way. You put your pyranometer outside, you set it and forget it. You just download the data every week. I mean, another example is the surface temperature protocol, which I think is Kevin Chakowsky's protocol, where you use, are some of you familiar with that? Tamara,
no.
You're probably familiar with it. It's one of the GLOBE protocols. He uses what are called handheld non-contact IR thermometers.
Mm-hmm.
They're the things, they look like a little gun. You know, you point them at something and it tells you what the temperature of the surface is.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you could buy them for about $40. Kids love them because they have laser beams on them for aiming, and, you know, you give it to a bunch of middle school boys, and they go around shooting things with their lasers if you don't turn them off. That's a measurement that you can make, but we also developed an instrument for continuous monitoring of surface radiating temperature. You set it up, hook it up to a data logger, and forget it. And it's maybe not a substitute for using these handheld IR thermometers, but it's a way to move past the cookbook part and just have the data that you can decide creatively what to do with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, yeah, I think there is a tension. I think you're right about that, that there is a tension between the protocols and wanting students to be creative.
Mm-hmm. Ask their own questions.
Hey, are there any other questions for David?
I'm sort of wondering who's still there.
We actually have 7 people still on the phone.
Oh, wow.
So.
They're very quiet.
Well, we are getting close to the end of the hour, and people do have to leave.
Sure.
We have had as many as 12 people on the phone for most of the time. So thank you very much, David, for it was a very interesting talk, and it's good to hear about your new project. And
I would like to hear from you if you're working with teachers and students who would like to take advantage of this program. I mean, it makes experiments possible that otherwise wouldn't be possible, either because the equipment is too expensive or too complicated or whatever.
So, David, one of the things you can do, so while there were 12 people on the phone today, the Clean Network Listserv has over 500 people on it now, and a lot of them represent groups, the people that have connections to teachers. So if you want to sort of advertise that the possibility of participating in your project, you could send this out to the Clean Network Listserv and ask them to pass it on to people who might be interested.
How would I get access to the listserv? What do I have to do? Because I definitely need to do that.
Just send an email to climateliteracynetwork@list.turk.edu, where you get my email from.
I don't know that I get yours. I haven't actually been registered. I just registered on CleanNet, but I don't think I've been getting your emails. I don't know.
You didn't get the reminder email this morning? With the phone number? Well, it's not. We'll figure that out.
No, I didn't.
We will get you on the list then. But and then you'll see what the email address is for the listserv.
Yes.
But there's
okay,
like 510 people on that now. So.
And they represent what do we find?
It's very much a network of networks.
Yeah, okay. Well, yes, I definitely need to send out something to those people.
All right, great. All right, well, thanks a lot. And we do have a speaker next, two speakers next week. Brian Drayton and Jilly Puttick from Turk, where I am from, are going to talk about the biological aspects of climate change. So there is more climate change work being done at Turk than just my efforts. So we'll hear from them next week.
Cool.
Thanks
great,
a lot.
Great. Thanks, everyone. Bye now.
All right.
Bye.
Bye.
Stay warm.
Bye. Thanks again.
Yes, keep warm.